Good morning, everyone. The Criminal Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee will come to order. Lindsay, please call the roll.
Chair Brannon.
Here.
Vice Chair Roach.
Present.
Ranking Member Grieco.
Here.
Representatives Barnaby has been excused. Beltran.
Here.
Busada Cabrera.
Here.
Bush.
Here.
Casello.
Here.
Chambliss.
Here.
Fetterhoff.
Here.
Gregory.
Here.
Haig has been excused. Learned.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
Rizzo.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Thompson.
Here.
Tuck.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lindsay. Before we begin, as always, a few reminders. I will ask everyone to please remember to silence your electronic devices. Also, a reminder for our members and presenters today, please ensure that you turn your microphone on. That's very important when you are speaking, and off when you are finished. I also request that you, anyone in the audience, please fill out a public appearance card if you intend to speak before the Criminal Justice and Public Safety Subcommittee today. Welcome back, members, to this late in the week meeting. Welcome back to the Criminal Justice Subcommittee. Today we'll have a discussion about 2022 legislative priorities of two organizations that I think play a crucial role in preserving public safety in Florida: the Florida Sheriff's Association and the Florida Police Chiefs Association. First, both organizations will have an opportunity to present their priorities to the subcommittee, and following that presentation, we'll save the member questions until the end and give everybody a chance to ask questions. Joining us today, we are pleased to have Sheriff Mike Atkinson, representing the Florida Sheriff's Association, and Chief Dan Slaughter, representing the Florida Police Chiefs Association. I'll give you a little background on both of our presenters today. Sheriff Atkinson has served as Sheriff of Walton County since 2008. Prior to being elected sheriff, he previously served as the Dufuniac Springs Chief of Police, as an officer with the Tallahassee Police Department, and as a parole officer with the Florida Department of Corrections. He currently serves on the Florida Criminal Justice Standards and Training Commission, is a board member of the National Sheriff's Association, and is a past president of the Florida Sheriff's Association. He holds a bachelor's degree in criminology from Florida State University and a master's degree in criminal justice administration from St. Leo University. Also, we have Chief Dan Slaughter. Chief Slaughter began his career with the Clearwater Police Department in October of 1992. In August of 2014, he was sworn in as the Clearwater Police Department's 13th Chief of Police, commanding the third largest law enforcement agency in Pinellas County. Prior to that position, Chief Slaughter served in a variety of assignments, including as the department's accreditation manager, a lieutenant assigned to command the Special Operations Section, and the Patrol Division. Chief Slaughter serves as the legislative chair for the Florida Police Chiefs Association. He is a graduate of Largo High School and the University of South Florida. So welcome both of you today. We appreciate you being here. And I can flip a coin, or Sheriff Atkinson, do you want to go first? If you're ready, we'll put you up first. And thank you for coming. Thank you for the job you do. Thank you for serving as a past president of the Sheriff's Association. I've been to about 15 or 20 summer and winter conferences, and I know what a commitment that takes. It's hard enough being a sheriff, but to step forward and serve the statewide organization is certainly something commendable. So thank you for your past service there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having us this morning, committee members. It's an honor to represent the Memorandum of Law Enforcement. I have to tell you, I'm a little more nervous than usual today. Usually when I'm in front of Judge Maney or Representative Maney, I always get a little tense and make sure my counsel's close by. All kidding aside, we appreciate the opportunity to come and speak for you today to just tell you a few things that we think of that are of interest as we move into 2022. Really the last couple of years have been about improving accountability for the men and women that we serve, the citizens of Florida, and our staff members. We want to do things that continue along that pathway, to build a trust equity with the people that are my bosses. One of the things that we're looking at this year, we're going to bring before you what we hope will improve some accountability and transparency in the Florida Model Jail Standards, and that is the opportunity to put a correctional medical professional on that board. We'll make some slight tweaks to that. We think that's an opportunity to be better in the way we conduct business. We're also looking at some opportunities to work with the juveniles on a juvenile bill to allow us to continue to to provide services to juveniles, but not do something that causes them an adverse reaction. Let me be specific what I'm talking about. Currently, as you may be aware, we can only hold a juvenile 21 days. So the problem becomes, even if they're out on electronic monitoring, if day 17 there's a new offense committed, you're only going to be able to hold that child for up to an additional 4 days. That can be problematic because realistically, children that are in need of services, we're not doing them any good by basically empowering or denying them the opportunity to get service by having that restricted time period of actual control and governance. So that's something we think is an opportunity. We also look forward on working toward a new drug bill, new policies that make smarter, deal with, you know, not just enforcement. And I think that's one thing that's important to understand, that when you talk about drug policies, there's not just an enforcement arm. There is also the preventative and treatment arm that are equally important. And that is something that we're going to continue working with House members and our Senate and your Senate counterparts to try and provide better policies that not only are transparent, we always say don't just be against something, be for things as well, be for things that make a positive difference in children's lives. And in the drug policies now, there's always room for improvement. So with that, I would just simply say that everything we want to do is continuation of an accountability. I think some steps that were taken by the legislature a couple of years ago, working in concert with the police chiefs and with the Sheriff's Association to improve transparency. Those are the kind of things we want to be for. And with that, I would end my statement.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. Chief, you'll come forward. I said I had been to 15 or 20 sheriff's conferences, but I did get to go to my first police chief's conference back in May in Hollywood, and served on the panel there with Senator Pizzo and Representative Byrd, and we had a good discussion. I appreciate the opportunity to come down, and thank you for coming and making the trip to see us today.
Thank you for having me, Chairman, and on behalf of the Florida Police Chiefs Association, our 900-plus members, our executive director, Jennifer Pritt, and our president, Director Stephen Dombinski. Just thank you for this opportunity to be in front of you today, to speak with you. And certainly, Representative Brennan, we are very grateful you participated in that panel. We really enjoy the collaboration. There's been...
Just a click. There you go. All right.
Thank you. But the past couple of years have been challenging for law enforcement. There's no denying that. But I'm just very happy to share with you that the men and women of the great profession that we serve in law enforcement, they are really good people, and they are doing a really hard job, and I believe they're doing it really, really well. We always want to, you know, our organization is always open to improving our profession and increasing accountability, but not painting things on a broad brush that affects the is a decision that's made because of the careless act of some really irresponsible individuals. In the next legislative session, the Florida Police Chiefs Association would like to focus on officer wellness, and specifically how it relates to receiving treatment for post-traumatic stress through workers' compensation coverage. We know that there is a prevalence of PTSD in law enforcement officers that is estimated to be 15%. 15% equates to 7,000 police officers in the state of Florida. We know the risk amongst law enforcement for suicide is 54% higher than the general public. And we know there's a stigma against seeking treatment for people in our profession, for whatever it may be, the macho syndrome or just the embarrassment, it's definitely an issue that we continue to try to work to break through. In 2018, a legislator took a very bold step in acknowledging PTSD as a legitimate occupational disease and required training to address the stigma associated with PTSD and encourage officers to get treatment. Under the current law, qualify for workers' compensation benefits under Chapter 440, first responders are entitled to workman's comp coverage for PTSD if reported within 52 weeks of a qualifying event and being symptomatic. The nature of these triggering events, they're very singular, focused on witnessing death, and the FPCA believes that current law erroneously presumes that PTSD may only be caused by a singular event that is caused only by witnessing death-related events, and that it is going to be promptly and correctly diagnosed, and ignores the aggregate impact of traumatic events experienced by Florida's law enforcement and their first responders during their entire career. The FPC always encourages our law enforcement officers to seek help when they are experiencing symptoms of PTSD and having suicidal thoughts, but the messaging can become mixed, And when a person comes forward only to be told that they don't qualify for treatment for workers' compensation coverage because of the arbitrary time limit or the triggering events that are too restrictive based on the research and the science. We can't ignore that officers can suffer from the cumulative PTSD from a series of traumatic events. And therefore, we believe that the responsible course of action is to modify Florida State Statute 112.1815 to provide a time constraint for reporting or to provide a time constraint for reporting that takes into consideration when the symptoms first manifest or when the conditions of PTSD are first diagnosed and are not arbitrary in their time limits. Additionally, we believe the statute should modify to allow for the accumulation of traumatic events witnessed by first responders, and those traumatic events are not only solely focused on incidents of death. We would also seek to reevaluate who can diagnose PTSD and suggest the statute include a clinical psychologist, not just a psychiatrist, as a professional able to make such a diagnosis. And the FPCA believes the standards for diagnosis should be set to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as opposed to clear and convincing medical evidence. To reduce this stigma and fulfill our responsibility to provide a treatment to our first responders that suffer mental injury during the course of their employment, we believe that this described modification is necessary. Other things important to our organization are recruiting and retention. We definitely appreciate the governor's incentives that they are proposing to bring more experienced law enforcement officers to our area. We believe that young officers don't necessarily always look at the pensions, but the experienced officers do, and that's who we want to attract. So we do believe there is some opportunity to look at some of the pensions related to moving to a 20-year retirement system and also potentially for age 55 with a minimum of eight years, reinstating the 3% COLA and cost of living adjustment, and developing some standardized career progression. We also believe that recruiting officers from outside the state, we could benefit from leveraging the extraordinary, Florida's extraordinary state university system. Currently in Florida, state employees may earn free college credits. Considerations of this benefit across the board to officers at any agency should be given, as well as the potential establishment of maybe like a Bright Blue Scholarship, where the officers could bank these credits and potentially use them for their children. The Florida Police Chiefs Association also enabled or impaneled a subcommittee on accountability and societal change. So along the line, the same comments of the sheriff, we are very committed to making sure that we improve accountability, transparency, and building very strong relationships in our community. This committee met for over the course of a year for nearly 30 times, and it was a panel of police chiefs and community representatives that were brought in by the police chiefs. The group focused on areas of enhancing trust, ensuring transparency and accountability, strengthening relationships between the police and the communities they serve, and we produced two comprehensive reports, one on use of force, and the second focused on recommended and actions items centered on the societal issues impacting law enforcement and their communities. And we believe that this, what we produced, is a wonderful roadmap for not only the individual communities, but the officers and the law enforcement agencies to work together to identify where their strengths and weaknesses are and to leverage those action items to improve their individual communities based on their individual needs. So in closing, Representative Brandon, I'll just, thank you so much for allowing us to be here. We definitely appreciate the collaborative environment we've been so fortunate to have in this state and the service of all your committee members and the ability that I've had to speak with some of you individually in the past has been very precious to me. So thank you.
Thank you, Chief Slaughter. Sheriff, you want to come up to the desk there. Members will now open it up for questions, and I want to ask the first one, and I'll ask of the sheriff something we briefly touched on as I came in there. I caught you in the hallway. Could you expand a little bit on, for lack of a better word, attitudes about as far as recruitment goes and some of the things you're facing about trying to get people to consider law enforcement as a career, some of the challenges there?
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you. As I was saying earlier, one of the things that I've seen, and this is my 28th year in this business, is this the first time that I've seen that we are actively pursuing but yet unable We're struggling to find the best and brightest. We're struggling to find men and women who want to come into this career. There's a myriad of reasons for that. But I will tell you what I find systemically problematic is that, as I said to you before, I teach a class at night at Florida State. And, you know, 131 students in this class, these are all criminal justice, criminology majors for the most part, about to graduate. And I asked this question. I said, you know, simply, how many of you, are, you know, where do you want to go to work? 131 students in a criminal justice program, zero wanted to be cops. That scares me. It scares me at multiple levels. I can tell you the lack of the concern about entering into this field is extremely problematic. And just very quickly, I can remember back in 2015, I spoke after the Ferguson grand jury verdicts came out at FAMU. And I asked this question, and I will tell you, the answer has not changed from 2015 to 2021. I said this. I had about 300 students in an auditorium, and I said, as quickly as you can, tell me the most important things that you think is important for a police officer, deputy sheriff, a law enforcement officer to do, as fast as you can give them to me. Write tickets, investigate crimes, arrest domestic violence folks, you know, work traffic crashes. I say, it's great. That's wonderful. All those things are true. On your way home today, you see an 80-year-old woman in the rain changing a tire, and you see a deputy sheriff drive past him. How do you feel about that? He should be fired. If he's not going to stop, I said, whoa, wait a minute. I just asked you to tell me what the most important things, your expectations were. You didn't say anything about changing a tire. And I think that's the problem. We in law enforcement have molded a public image that is not necessarily consistent with the duties in which both the citizens want and what we actually do. I mean, we know, Mr. Chair, you know this as well. You know, fully 85% of what we do is in the social service realm. And anybody that says that's not true is simply just not familiar with the facts. And I think that as we deal with people that are mentally ill, addiction issues, and a variety of societal issues, in our profession, we've got to do a better job of accurately portraying what it is we want. And then we have to help in showing the public what it is we do, because I'm telling you there is a real disconnect, that there is a lot of good men and women that want to be engaged in public service. They want to be engaged in public service, and they're not coming to us. And I for one, and I think I can speak for FSA in general in this regard, I am not going to lower my standard to fill these roles. I'm just not going to do it. But the strain of that is significant.
Thank you. I understand that. I spoke to a recruit graduating class the other day, and I tell them all the time, get out of the car. Spend a moment with that elderly person who maybe just wants to take a minute to show you the tattered pictures in their wallet to talk about their families. So much of what police officers do is above and beyond what people expect them to do. And we do need to recruit the best sons and daughters we have out there to do this kind of work, because it really is. It's a public service. It's got to be in your heart. And I appreciate you making the comment that you are not going to lower your standards, even with that issue, with that problem, because that's the type of folks that we do need out there. Representative Learning, I recognize you for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's all right, I have two. One is just a quick follow-up to what you just said. So last week I'm in every judicial committee, so they all kind of merge together. But we heard testimony from the Department of Corrections, and they were saying that they're losing a lot of their good corrections officers to county jails because county jails, frankly, pay a lot better than the state prisons do. As a follow-up to your point about, you know, it's hard for you to hire people. Do you know what percentage of your guards are coming from state prisons? Is that something that you're taking advantage of, or are we in a bidding war against each other? I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that briefly.
That would be yes and yes. So the short answer is staffing is a significant concern, both in the county jails and the state institutions. And obviously, as much loyalty as I would love to show the DOC, I simply have positions that have to be filled as well, right? I mean, that is a major issue. But the one thing I would touch about money, and I want to be, money is an important item if your basic needs are being met. But there's some pretty substantial studies from the London School of Economics, and I can refer that to you if you'd like to see it. But it basically says that If your basic needs are being met, that which motivates people is really three things: mastery, autonomy, and purpose, right? And so you want to be good at the job you do. You want to have autonomy in the way you do these things, and what you do has to matter. I would add an additional thing is appreciation. But that only works when your needs are met. But I think one of the struggles that they're having at DOC at multiple levels and in the jails as well is an identity of crisis, right? And then conditions which are not conducive to making you feel that you're a master of what you're doing or the autonomy. It is, and I don't want to speak for Secretary Inch, I just think they're in such a bad situation that there is not the answer. There's multiple answers. There's multiple bites to this problem. Because if you gave me $50,000 raise, but you told me that I was going to work, you know, 60 hours, 70 hours a week, and I'm never going to be able to take off, and I'm on rotating shifts, and, you know, once your needs are met, you've got to deal with both parts. So there's not just the answer. There's multiple parts.
Go ahead.
Follow, Mr. Chair. Thank you. In line with the same type of question, we heard testimony yesterday from the clerk's office, the judicial silo, saying that they're rapidly going through the backlog of cases. And in response to the same question about the same issue, they said that we should expect more people entering county jails and state prisons in the months to come. Because the system is in such a crisis point now, your jails are that middle spot, right, between the courts and the state prisons. I just wanted to ask you, frankly, on the record, do you expect more people going to state prisons in the next few months? And give you an opportunity to talk about what's happening in your jails right now.
I can ask.
Yeah, so thank you for the question. So I think there's a couple of things about that. I mean, just fundamentally, yes, as the courts gear back up, that's got to be dealt with. You're going to have this influx. A compounding problem, and you touched on this, is going to be DOC's current situation where they are understaffed and are crowded. So unfortunately, and I think Secretary Inch has elaborated on this, is that those folks are now, there's going to be a longer delay in coming out of county jail, which are going to further stress the system at the local level. You know, from particularly Walton County, I'm just going to use the panhandle of Florida for just a second. So we are staffed exceptionally well. But I will tell you, just pragmatically, that I think Escambia County paid us somewhere in the neighborhood of 20-some-odd million dollars over the course of about 4 years because they were so overcrowded that they were close to what I would, you know, a federal consent decree if you get to certain points. That is replicated across multiple places. If you want to reduce interaction and you want to make it safe for correctional officers, you have to have an environment that is both safe for the inmates, consequently it's safe for the staff. And those are things that are going to matter. But I have a real fear of the backlog at DOC funneling back into the county. So it's something that's got to be dealt with.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding the incentives. Is there any stipulation regarding how long an officer has to remain on the force in order to qualify for the incentive so that there's not a revolving door of people coming in, taking the incentive, and leaving?
Representative Thompson, I can't say that I have seen all the language on how they apply completely. I can only say what I've heard has been proposed. I would say that our association would be supportive of language that protected us from such things. We would not want any type of an environment where people were able to come in and make a money grab and leave. We're also not looking for somebody else's dirty laundry either. I mean, we want to make sure that we have well-vetted officers that come from outside, if they come into this profession, that are meet the high standards that both I would demand and the sheriffs alluded to, that they're in the same boat. We're not going to lower our standards. So the incentives would simply be to maybe encourage people to come to the great state of Florida and serve their communities that they would hopefully adopt as home for a long time.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Chambliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back when we were talking about in recruiting and the the current narrative of a being law enforcement officer compared to what a law enforcement officer actually does. How can we help in changing that narrative? Real quick, I wanted to be a cop out of college because I wanted to protect people. My mom cried me out of it, you know. And you see where I'm at now. Excuse me. So that's kind of what I want to talk about a little bit. Like, how can we, is there legislation that could help in the narrative campaign? Could we individually help with that? Because we do know that there are issues with trust in the community, and so therefore little kids, you know, aren't necessarily wanting to grow up and be cops like they used to. What can be done more from our seat to help you in changing that narrative and attracting the best and the brightest, and making sure that kids who do want to protect their community have a direct path to being a law enforcement officer?
I would say from my standpoint, I think a couple of things. One is modeling the expectations and behavior. I think we're not doing a good job of that from a profession standpoint. I don't think we're doing a good job of that. But I'll give you a couple of quick examples. It takes about 790 hours, give or take. I think that's about where it's at for the basic recruit school, 790-plus hours. It's about 1,800 to be a hairdresser, cosmetologist in the state of Florida. So what do we value in here? I would say that if you go through the police academy now, there is nothing on real what I call customer service, right? There is no real discussion about mediation. There's no real discussions on the things so that when we hire men and women and we get to the academy and we're focusing on certain traits, we have things that are high risk, right? But it's also low probability. We also have things that are high frequency, but they are necessary, may or may not be low risk, but the high frequency things, I think if we did a better job of explaining to people what we are actually doing and what the actual expectations of those are, because I'll make this simple. If I ask you what makes a good, how do you know what a good police officer is? Was that they make arrests? What if they never write a ticket? What if they... Malcolm Gladwell has a great analogy for this in his one of his books, Outliers, and he talks about this idea of they're all good, right? We each bring different life experiences to this. What we've got to stop doing, I think, and this is Mike Atkinson, Chief Slaughter may see it a little bit differently, but I think we're going to be on the same page here. We have to create an environment in the training that allows for different emotional IQ, some of the things you'll hear that, an emotional IQ, that brings a depth and variety of experience, not just one that is based upon a military model in and of itself. In and of itself, there is a place for that because, quite frankly, Chair Brennan, as you know, there is a time I'm going to tell you to do something and I don't expect to negotiate, right? But that's not every time. And so understanding when that is appropriate is huge, but we have to train people how to do it. So I do think I sit on the Criminal Justice Standards and Training Commission. I do think I'm very much a proponent for increasing the rigor and time of the training and to accurately portray what I think are modern job skills and things that are important to us for the importance of duty. And I joke with my friends at the Police Chiefs Association. I always say, do you know the difference between a police officer and a deputy sheriff? You say, well, no, what is that, sheriff? And I say, well, it's real simple. A police officer should solve crime. Deputy sheriff should solve a problem. That's my philosophy, and I think that should be, and it is their philosophy as well, too. I just like picking on them. But I think that's a great opportunity to put that, inculcate that into the police academies.
Chief, do you want to respond to that?
Not to the last part. We have a lot of fun in our profession going back and forth, and I think that's a good example of it. With response to the question, I would say that it was a big focal point of our subcommittee on societal change and accountability. And I thought that the discussions were very healthy as we focused on some of the concepts of making sure that you're just collaborative with the community on your policing strategies. I think sometimes policing strategies can really erode exactly what you're talking about, and it really marries up, I think, exactly what the sheriff's saying, that what a police officer brings to the table that is most valuable, it's discretion. And a person with good emotional intelligence that properly applies discretion and works to solve a problem for what's best for the community is really what we want. You know, we in my particular organization, we stress a lot. You get the seven, and he's made a great point that the academy has this, and it could be extended. So we end up, a lot of us end up making up stuff that's not in the academy because we want our people to have it. And we stress in our post-academy, we call it, doing very deliberate in contact and engagement with communities in the greatest need. That's non-enforcement. And we really stress that that's a priority for us. And, you know, I don't know if you really achieve it through legislation as much as it is just through your strong leadership, that that is a priority for our community.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A follow-up to that, could you talk a little bit about the community, like the community policing model, the officer-friendly model, and how that plays into how you advertise or kind of how you market the idea of wanting to be a law enforcement officer, if it does or not?
To really embrace a community policing philosophy, it's certainly much more involved than simply putting a substation in a neighborhood and saying you are assigned there. Our philosophy, or the way we approach it, starts right with the recruiting video. If you watch our recruiting video, it is all about community engagement and community collaboration, and making sure that we attract people that have that particular mind focus. When I review people that we're bringing on board, I look for people that are civic-minded, that are volunteering, that are doing things along those lines. And then making sure they understand that their role is not to go out there and necessarily just enforce, but you have to develop the partnership first. And in the partnership is where you determine with your community what needs to be addressed and what is the highest priority for the community. And just create those trusting relationships at that moment. It all comes together with making sure that you're having those non-enforcement engagement opportunities where people feel comfortable collaborating with you and building a relationship. You know, there's always this focus on, you know, do people trust the police department? I don't think people will probably ever trust a government organization, but what they do trust is people, okay? And they trust police officers who are individual people. And I think in embracing that philosophy at the very beginning, you know, we actually, again, in our post-academy, have a segment where we talk about the history of community policing and what the expectation is, and I think that was something that is critically important when you're onboarding the employees to establish what the priorities are for your organization.
And I absolutely support everything the chief just said. I think he's fundamentally right. You know, one of the things that we say in our organization, we use this idea of a currency of trust, right? That's an economic principle, but you see that played out in Yelp, Airbnb, things like that, where communities are deciding what restaurants you may go eat at, in large part maybe by how they were rated, right? And you build that over a period of time with community by repeatedly doing the same things well and engaging. The problem I see a lot of agencies across the country doing is they have some major misstep, maybe a bad officer, maybe it's a systemic thing. I don't know the answer to that. But I will tell you what happens is immediately they will tell you they have changed and things are all better, and trust me now. That doesn't work. You can't withdraw trust from a bank when you've made no deposits. So you want to see an organization failing at community-oriented policing, show me somebody with a community-oriented policing unit. It has to be what the chief said. It has to be a inculcated culture. And I think that is really the key. You don't do that overnight. You build that over repeatedly doing the same thing, right? That's Aristotle's definition of excellence, right? It's what you do again and again and again that it becomes habit. I actually think that's it. I think one of the pressure you as the legislature feel, and one of the things we feel as police chiefs and sheriffs, is this immediacy to, we've got to make this change. We've got to make this change and make people trust us. Mike Atkinson thinks that's a fundamentally wrong approach. I think you've got to do what you're going to do, continually be better at the way you do it, and weather the storm and the many times legitimate criticism of policies and procedures. You make them better where you can, but you do not adjust what should be your guiding principles in the way you do business.
Thank you. I will point out the sheriff made me feel totally inadequate when I graduated in 1987. I only had to have 360 hours of training. Yeah, right. But I would point out and add to that that with mandatory retraining and career development courses, about 4 or 5 years later, I was looking at my personnel file one day, and I had 2,000 hours already of additional training beyond that. Plus, I had a degree from the University of Florida, and that counted for a whole lot.
A little bit. So, Mr. Chair, I wonder, maybe I should clarify that a little bit. I think my point was that before they get to the agencies, the agencies spend countless hours trying to follow up on that and customize to it. But I think one of the points I did not articulate well was that the academies don't necessarily give them a representation of what is going to happen on the job. So that's why they're quitting in the first year, because once we start training them and say, no, this is what you're really going to do. Representative Manning and I have had, extensive conversation about mental health and crisis intervention training. And I've had deputies say, whoa, that's not what they taught me in the police academy. I mean, I guarantee you Chief Slaughter's heard the same thing. So that's kind of what I meant was I think we should do a more accurate picture up front so that the agencies really have to spend less time on what I consider basic fundamentals. But you're right. By the end of the first 2 years, you've got hundreds and hundreds of hours on top of that.
And I'm going to go to Ranking Member Grieco next. But let me ask one more question to dovetail with that. What is the average field training program
when they go
to work for you?
And I think for most accredited agencies, Chief, it was probably going to be identical.
Yeah, most, I think, use some form of a San Jose model, which generally tends to be anywhere between 16 to 18. Some have additional periods in there, but I'd say the minimum you'll see is going to be in the area of 14.
Weeks.
Can I make a plug for accreditation? There are 18,000. I testified before the presidential committee on this last year. There are over 18,000 agencies in the United States. Less than 1,000 are accredited.
Wow.
Florida has one of the most strenuous accreditations in the nation. We have 400-plus agencies, give or take. I'm a little long, but less than 100, I believe, are actually accredited. Somebody may correct me on that, but it's not much more than that. So I think one of the things that was going to happen, you're going to see, like I know the Florida Sheriff Association has made a decision, a conscious decision, they're going to set aside money to help supplement and help develop, because many of these agencies want to be accredited. They're just simply so small, they lack the resources. That's going to help a lot.
But that decals a source of pride when it gets on there, because it is a very, here in Florida, sure, national, but really here in Florida, very strenuous thing to go through and expensive. Ranking Member Grieco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to both of you. I have two questions completely unrelated. So the first one is about FRS retirement and keeping on reserve officers, or the inability to do so. So I've gone down a very strange rabbit hole over the last week after speaking to some of my local officers, and it was brought to my attention that if you retire on FRS, you have to discontinue doing anything, including, for the folks on the committee that don't know, being a reserve officer, which is you essentially are a police officer for free. And there is a rule at FRS, and I guess based upon information I got yesterday, it's from a directive from the IRS, I don't know. But if you retire, you have to be off the books, even if you want to volunteer for a year. And during that time, we've got, again, some of the smaller municipalities that would love to have a free officer for special events and things like that. And then that officer would love to be able to easily have an uninterrupted credential throughout the process. Can you speak to that? And is there anything that we can do? Is that something that you're experiencing? Is that and can you speak to that? And then, again, tell us what we can do to maybe move the needle on this.
It has definitely been expressed as a concern from our membership. My organization is not FRS, so individually it doesn't necessarily impact me, but the things that you've alluded to are accurate. They're a problem. I don't know if I'm intelligent or aware enough to speak if it's an IRS ruling or a interpretation at state rule level that might be able to be changed, but it's a problem not only with the reserves, but even with the criminal justice institutes that tend to have officers that are work as trainers, and then as they separate from their organizations, they're not allowed to be trainers for 12 months, and that's a loss of intellectual capital that I don't think is very beneficial. We've even seen struggles as people have retired from Like, say you retire from as a high-level executive, you know, sheriff's department under FRS, and you are trying to be hired as a police chief at another city that may be part of FRS as well, they are unable to be rehired, and it's you're not really marketable as a chief after you've taken the 12 months off. It's not really a good resume builder, and so it's definitely an issue. I don't know if it's best solved through legislation or through addressing it through rulemaking issues, but it's definitely a problem. It's been expressed by membership. Thank you for bringing it up.
And I think, you know, this issue came up of not being able to volunteer, obviously it was a surprise. It had not been interpreted that way previously, right? But I think working, there's been some work done with DMS to try and negotiate or come to a policy to at least allow some limited scope of duties for those individuals. I mean, I think that's something that is obviously should be reviewed maybe from a time frame standpoint. It's obviously problematic. Now, I know Sheriff Galtieri out of Pinellas County had spoken with DMS staff and tried to work some out that will now allow a limited scope of work. So that's certainly an improvement. I'm not going to tell you we haven't had hiccups with that because we have had some issues where we're trying to get that corrected. It obviously for us, we want those people back. They want to work. We want them back. So if they can't even volunteer, it's obviously an issue.
Thanks. Thanks, Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Well, it's on my radar anyway, and I've put it on Rep. Snyder's radar, and I've put it on the Chair's radar prior to today. So we're going to work on it. Unrelated question. I want to talk briefly about hemp and marijuana. And as you all know, a couple of years ago, hemp got legalized. And as a result, it's had a huge impact on law enforcement's ability to even make any sort of Terry stop or anything along those lines because the public consumption, it's an end around for public consumption. And I believe that a couple other members of this committee are going to be working on that this session. But can you speak to the problems that we're having statewide? And let me preface this by saying that I have a medical marijuana card. I'm very supportive of the medical marijuana program. But even if you go out to Colorado, you can't legally consume marijuana in public. But because hemp was legalized in Florida, and the consumption of hemp smoke, if one were to smoke, it smells the same. There's been state's attorneys and legal opinions throughout the state that it's impacting your ability to make stops. Can you speak to the impact that's had on the law enforcement community in being able to make those investigatory stops based upon public consumption of what could be marijuana or could be hemp, and if we potentially need to rethink that legislation, at least a part of it?
So I would say that it's definitely been a problem. A lot of agencies ended up adopting what's been commonly referred to as an odor plus standard to try to account for the impact of hemp. I think the officers have been able to relatively navigate that particular issue, making the best of the situation. I think it's been more for us as a challenge with a public-facing problem is you have people that may use hemp and may smoke it openly, and the public is frustrated that they feel that that's going on right in the backyard and causing a lot of issues. We related to the hemp is kind of the Delta 8, version, which is as businesses opening up and having in my particular community, they have a bong hour at 5 p.m. and it's not too far from restaurants, and the restaurants don't necessarily appreciate the odor and the perception of what's going on. I think it's definitely a problem. I don't know what the solution is for this one, though. I mean, it's definitely going to work its way through the courts. There's been some cases that have been helpful and some that have been hurtful. So it's kind of getting probably working its way towards some form of a balance. The best way we've been able to deal with it is this odor plus standard, which is the best we have right now.
Well, as a backstory, I sat on the Hemp Council for the Department of Agriculture that this body formed to determine how is the appropriate uses for industrial hemp, right? So obviously a very different product than medical cannabis, right? But the issue that I have seen that has become, I think, apparent to me over the last few years is
you have two issues. Walton County, for instance, arguably one of the most conservative counties in the state of Florida. Okaloosa, Walton, you're right there in an extremely conservative pathway. Even in those counties, medical cannabis passed by 77%. And so what you're seeing is the public's, we're in this nebulous zone of, can we prove that it's cannabis, right? Because that's problematic. Now for the dogs, that's becoming a non-sequitur issue in regard to maybe you have the medical marijuana cards. You know, what? So there is just really a myriad of policy, and I think what's happening with we police with the consent of the people, right? And so I'm not sure where the will of the people, I know what the law is, but I'm not sure what the will of the people is in regard to what direction the legislature and the people want to take in this matter. And so, you know, judiciously, what we're trying to do is we make cases that meet that legal threshold and that standard, but it has become decidedly more difficult and is an extremely confusing situation. And then maybe that's a little too obtuse, but that's probably as best as I can put it.
Go ahead.
Sorry, he made me think I wanted to add one thing. I think the challenge that you have to deal with, and unfortunately it's the legislature's, is when people, think about legislation associated with marijuana, the thought is, of course, medical. I think everybody, I think that's probably well understood. It has a certain value. And even, when people think, what's the big deal? You make marijuana recreational, whatever, some people, the person that may have, a joint once a month, I think that's what people's perception is. But now put that in and you legalize recreational marijuana or even Delta 8 or even some of these derivatives, and now you have people that, a mom that's raising three kids in an apartment complex, and all she has is people in the next door that do nothing but smoke it all day. And it's a different problem. That's why I respect all of you so much, because trying to craft a legislation that allows one but doesn't have a slippery slope is so complicated. So this is a tough one. Sorry, I couldn't give you anything better, sir.
Thank you for the question. Representative Gregory and I came out of our apartment complex this morning, and he probably can tell you what I said because I got a whiff of something, and I was like, my gosh. That's for another day. I want to ask a real quick question. You mentioned dogs. And for lack of a better word, I know I never worked a police dog, but I've been around them. And I know you can't untrain a dog. Have you had to lose dogs and replace them? And what does that cost?
Right now it's still illegal, minus the medical card and the hemp. So we are openly debating whether or not to invest in these canines in the future with that, because I just simply don't know what the will of the people is going to be. And, at the end of the day, quite frankly, it doesn't matter what I think about it. It matters what the people think and what you as a legislature decide. I'm going to abide by the laws that are passed. But before I invest several hundred thousand dollars just in the dogs and training, I would like to know where we're going forward. So, at this point, when we go to buy a new dog, I don't know that we're going to train them on that odor until such time as the last animal we have is no longer serviceable. Then we're going to have to look around and try and anticipate where you're at. If it's still on the books the same way, identical, then we'll do that again. But every time we go before the court, this is going to be a challenge. It's going to be an issue.
It just hit me when you said that. I thought about it. I said, that's got to be a big expense because you cannot untrain them once they are trained to alert marijuana. Representative Casilla.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me. Chiefs, thank you for coming here today. You've been very enlightening. My question is that I do believe that we have some of the best trained men and women out there on the streets here in Florida in law enforcement. My question is that you spoke about the hundreds of hours of training and all, and you used the word that I found interesting. You said appreciation. With that being said, with the men and women, the street cop that's out there right now, what is the overall perception from the public? We've read many stories, negative stories, if you will, throughout the last couple of years about bad cops. That puts like a dark blanket over the whole department. So my question is, what is the morale of the men and women who protect us, the overall morale?
It's been very difficult. It's been a difficult period of time. But I am also very optimistic, and the ones that are still in the profession, they have a level of confidence that they're doing a good job for the right reason. But with that said, our turnover rate in this past year was three times what it normally is. So we did turn over some people. There was, I think, many factors of that, and one of them being, we have a community that's very, very supportive in Clearwater, and a very good city to police in. It's, I think, one of the best cities to police. The community is just very supportive. However, where I as a leader may have failed is I did not properly determine how impactful social media was on officers. Even though the work environment they had was good, still seeing the negativity that comes with that platform took a toll. And I lost three times before I figured it out. So I think we will come out of this stronger as we always have in this profession. I think we'll learn from it. And in the end, the country's made up of a lot of good people who just want nothing more than a safe community. And in the end, they just want good police officers that they trust. And that's what we want to be anyway. So how can this be that big of a problem? We just need to continue to work towards, a common goal.
I would say, maybe a couple of things. An organization line, I have roughly, not all law enforcement officers, but roughly about 600 employees. And at the height of last year, I was at some points had as many as 54 deputy sheriff positions unavailable, 24 vacancy, and people so new that they're constantly in training. The new normal that I have seen is that people do not choose this as a career. This is a 3 to 5 year and out. And I think that's really problematic for the citizens we serve, because by the time they start learning to do their job well, the real return on investment is about 5 years. They're gone. So the first 18 months I'm spending, the military shifted their approach to doing this a few years ago. They understand that they're not going to have as many career military folks, right? And they're trying to maximize what they get in the shortest amount of time. We haven't been able to make that adjustment. I'm not sure that it's conducive for us to make that adjustment. But I will tell you, we've got to find a way, because they don't look at it as something. They're not going to come in and get I've had them say, Sheriff, I could get the same, pension here, or I can make more money doing there, or whatever that is. That's not really who we want at the end of the day to be the sole reason, right? That's a factor like we talked about before. But we're going to have to figure out how to support them in a manner that makes them want to choose this as a career. And the body cameras was the thing that tipped me. The body cameras was the thing that threw me when I realized I was out of touch on this, which was when we talked about putting body cameras, overwhelmingly, the deputies wanted them. And I was shocked. I've been at this a long time. That shocked me that they all wanted body cameras. But that tells you just how afraid they are of getting in trouble. They feel like the only way to defend themselves in many cases is to have this camera. And I'm not sure that's good for, regardless of how you feel about body cameras, I don't think that's good for this profession. So I'm not sure.
Thank you, Representative. I'll go to Representative Maney next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I really want to thank the sheriff and the chief for coming, and Representative Leonard for asking two of my three questions. But I would like to get each of your thoughts on the efficacy or need to change provisions of the Baker Act. It's been my experience that local law enforcement are a major source of Baker Act evaluations. And I just wonder how your officers, your agencies, your organizations feel about the current Baker Act and whether it's meeting the public's needs. So I don't know who wants to go first, but I would love to know your all's reactions. Thank you.
Representative, I'll try to take a stab. I will say that it's nothing that I've necessarily researched or that our association membership's taken a position on. I think those of us that are in the law enforcement profession recognize that we often get called on to fill gaps, and we have filled a gap with in mental health, and the Baker Act's been a tool that hasn't necessarily felt always effective. I think using the Baker Act as kind of the entry level for to get services as opposed to having other mechanisms to provide services, I think has been complicated. I think there are studies that are pretty clear that officers, not for a malicious intent, but merely for a fear of making a mistake and somebody, taking their life, probably over Baker Act, and Baker Act on more times than they need. I know experiencing this myself, we had issues in the schools where I felt we were Baker Acting when we didn't necessarily need to, and we're able to leverage some services and create some different pipelines. So I'd be interested in hearing what tweaks people feel that they'd like to make to it, but I think it's a tool that may not necessarily be broken, but may just be overutilized. And if we had other resources available to us, I think officers would tend to utilize other tools in their tool belt, but right now they're tethered to just having the one tool, which is the Baker Act.
I mean, I think there's significant room for improvement in the application of a Baker Act. At the end of the day, I probably am the largest in custody or the largest residential provider for mental health in the county, and I'm betting that's close to being true in most counties in the state of Florida. That's a sad indictment for where we're at, and really many times, as you well know, we'll Baker Act individuals 20, 30 times in a year, easily. It's a blunt instrument that does not work well for what should be very much more specific. I'd really like to see some opportunity for either it's expanded period of time or similar to what we're doing with the safety evaluations with the school in the schools. To make sure that we're using it. It's just not the best tool. It needs to be updated, it needs to be modernized, and be consistent with what services are available for us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge. I used to Baker Act somebody, and the joke was 3 days later I was going to deal with them again because they were going to be back out. And we had a state mental hospital in our county. That was very frustrating. We've got this huge facility here, and it was a revolving door, so it's certainly something that needs to be addressed, and thank you for bringing up that point. I'll go back to Representative Thompson for another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that you are looking at how you use the Baker Act and willing to reevaluate that. My question has to do with detention of juveniles. And you mentioned how long you can detain a juvenile. I've read a number of reports regarding the long-term trauma and psychological effects of holding juveniles in solitary confinement. And so I'd like to know what the policy in general is regarding holding juveniles in solitary confinement.
Yeah, I mean, I'll speak just very bluntly. You shouldn't be doing that. Solitary confinement as a general rule has been brought out of practice. That's a bad practice. It's not in a best practice model. If you look at Florida model jail standards, that really should not be happening. Now, let's be clear about a couple of things. One, if we get into close custody, a suicide watch, things of that nature, or where they're unsafe to be with someone else, that's a little bit different situation, right? But that's not a true solitary confinement. That's more of a medical situation. One of the problems that happens with, and I'm touching on the juvenile, the date, that rule was developed in the 80s. And at that time, I don't think there was near the burden on the juvenile justice system to get to court there is now. I mean, I think that's really the problem. I think they were much more able to get in front of a judge, to get in front of a hearing back in the 80s. 21 days now, they are simply they're not getting referred to services. And with a child, if discipline in anything should be what? Fair, swift, and consistent. You take away swift and you take away consistent so that it's 17 days of electronic monitoring, I commit a new offense, but you can't hold me but for 4 more days. We've got an issue. We've got to find ways to get these kids into services faster. But in regard to the solitary confinement, I would challenge if we find somebody doing that, that needs to be corrected immediately.
Thank you. I'll go back to Representative Lerner for another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my my question is for the chief. Something you touched on earlier caught my attention. It has to do with discretion. And I want to be really careful about this because I feel strongly for criminal justice reform. And, you know, I want to spend less than $5 billion housing 90,000 Floridians. But the concept of discretion, I think by its very nature, can lead to accusations of discrimination and unequal policing, and at least the perception that some of us have seen in the public. So I wanted to just give you an opportunity to talk briefly about who has the discretion, at what point does discretion end, and is there opportunities to add additional layers of discretion to the process that might lead to a more equitable policing model?
Well, I think it's incumbent on people in my seat and the executives I have that work with me to continually monitor how it's being applied and to make sure that it is a fair and a balance. Of course, any situation where it's discriminatory or biased based on race, gender, or any discriminatory, we would not tolerate. I think what I'm trying to reference how the importance of the emotional intelligence is so we have, like many agencies, a preferred arrest policy for domestic violence. Okay, and I think in an environment, I think, you know, when you think domestic violence, you think, you know, couple fighting, male hits woman, and, you know, domestic violence charge. A true story is, you know, in our organization, we made a domestic violence arrest for a mother who is elderly, who had an incorrigible daughter who you know, spit on her. Technically, it's a domestic. And because of the pervert arrest policy, we took the pregnant daughter to jail when I think we could have said, go stay with this other person. So to me, those are discretion that I think, you know, we always want to encourage. We need to create a safe environment where people can, you know, have the ability to make some of those decisions. If we create an environment where a camera's on here, here's the rule, and there's no discretion, that's the point I'm making. We will have a very, I think, negative relationship with our community if it's that rigid. But I think, you know, like many organizations, we're continually reviewing our data to try to see where it's very easy to track is traffic citations. I mean, I don't think it's mandated, but we track our citation data based on warnings given to race, gender, and we compare that and try to make sure that we're equitable. It's work. It's just work. And we have to make sure that we're continually challenging our decisions and not you know, beating down and punishing an officer, but refining and educating them and developing them. You know, they're not going to be perfect 2 years out of the gate. But the 20-year guy generally has learned a lot over the course of his career, and he wants to do the right thing. And I think we just need to empower him.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I know you guys are doing God's work out there. The follow-up is simply, is there anything we as a legislature can do to help you and your officers in that process?
I think some of the initiatives that the legislature's already put in place, the criminal justice transparency, and I think even the Fibers program, that once that's up and running, that we'll have access to data and be able to evaluate data. We're in the infancy of how we use data in law enforcement. There is so much data there that we have not been able to leverage yet just because we're still getting the infrastructure built. Once the Uniform Crime Affidavit and I think a lot of the other products that are in the pipeline, I think we'll be in a much better position to continually evaluate ourselves and grow.
Representative Chambliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the subject about PTSD. And officers who are experienced PTSD. I heard you mentioning there was a length of time along with the symptoms. So my question is, is there anywhere where you have, say, a reasonable circumstance that kind of is outside the length of time and symptoms? Because many people don't admit that they're having the symptoms, you know what I mean? Because again, we're all tough guys, right? Is there any measurement that you have outside of that one that would say, based on what you just went through, you probably have PTSD, right? Like, because, for example, just give a quick example for the purpose of the question. An officer that has been in multiple contact shootings, right? Multiple. And seems all right. Seems good on the outside, but based on human nature, probably isn't as good as it seems. Because the fear would be that that one time when he's making that decision, right? Because we want our officers to go home to their families. But that one time, because he's done it so much, the one time that he second guesses himself and he hesitates, now he's the one who shot. And so is there any way to kind of say, hey, you probably have PTSD, so this is what we, this is the therapy or whatever is needed that you need to go through?
I will tell you, and I know Chief Slaughter has too, personally experienced, you know, I had a deputy sheriff involved in a shooting in 2005, which two Okaloosa County deputies were killed. And then subsequently, that individual was involved with 67 rounds fired in 20 seconds. One of the people that survived it was the distance of that shooting, that 20 rounds fired by the perpetrator that had just killed two Okaloosa County deputies, was as close as you as I, you and I. Bullets all around him, didn't hit him. We did at the time, which was normal procedure, an evaluation of him, everything we thought was fine. 5 years, 5.5 years later, he has continued to do a fantastic job for us. And in fact, I was looking at being promoted to lieutenant. He had been promoted and was looking to be promoted to lieutenant. And the district commander came to see me and said, listen, this sergeant is, he's down there turning his equipment and he's quitting. I said, what are you talking about? What do you mean he's quitting? I couldn't understand it. I said, bring him down. I said, he's turning his stuff down there. He comes in my, I said, go get him and bring him up here. They bring him up into my office, and I won't call his name, but I said, what's going on here? I'm quitting. I'm doing something else. And I said, you know, you do a fabulous job. You're a fantastic deputy sheriff. You're a fantastic supervisor. He said, I can't do this anymore. I said, what are you talking about? He said, every time the radio goes, today's going to be that day. We failed him. I failed him. He gained almost 100 pounds in that 5 years. He has three children. He walked off his job. He was quitting his job because I failed to provide him services. That's the bottom line. I can slice. That's a failure of leadership on my part, right? He didn't have another job. He was walking out and quitting. So, you know, we were able to at least take him into another field and send him to training. But from that experience, and there have been numerous, and I know Chief Slaughter could give you examples of that as well. He hadn't even told his wife, by the way. He was walking off the job right then. I said, I want to manage like Mama. Mama doesn't care if you like it. I care if you're safe and you're successful. So we started saying, you're going to have mandatory counseling. Every one of you don't like it, somebody else is hiring. You're going to go to therapy. And what we did was take that stigma away by saying, be mad at the sheriff. Be mad at the sheriff. You're going to go get this counseling. You know what? You don't need it. It's fine. Good for you. But you're also not singled out because you're one of hundreds that have to go do this. So I think that, to me, is step one, and it's something we do now. You're going to do it as long as you work with us. You know, am I right? I don't know. Am I overstepping? Maybe. That's what they make appeals courts for. But the end of the day, that's the advantage. I mean, I don't, you know, in full disclosure, I don't have to ask anybody to do it. I don't have unions. I don't have to, you know, until a judge, and they love telling me no. So as soon as one of them comes and tells me I can't do it, I'm going to do what I think's in the best interest of the deputy. But that's a great example of where I think something we were afraid to do for so long. If you'd have told me I had to go see mental health counseling, I'd have been on strike mutiny around there, you know. I don't know. I just think these are the things we've got to do. We've got to try and take a lead to protect these folks. And I think it starts with destigmatizing mental health and providing them with the services. And sometimes, you know, they said you can't lead a horse to water to make him drink. You hold his head in it long enough, he'll start drinking. And sometimes that's what it takes, if it's for the best reasons.
So if I'm going to steal the manage by mama thing. I like that. But you're hitting on exactly what is my concern. Okay, so the concern is you really have to have two elements for this workman's comp provision to apply, which is they got to have a qualifying event, and you have to be symptomatic within 52 weeks. Not notice, So, you know, currently there is a member of my organization that was shot at and is and actually made notice within the 52 weeks, but didn't say he was symptomatic at that point, but the nightmares have continued. I mean, they call it post-traumatic stress, not present traumatic stress. So to try to think that it has to happen within a year, and any of us, and I venture to guess that you probably have a hard time finding any officer that doesn't have some form of it, whether or not it requires treatment or anything. I mean, I did death investigations for a long time, and I saw a lot of autopsies, and some of them were babies. And there was a one incident where the medical examiner, who felt very sad for the death that he was working, we were working side by side with him as he's doing his exam, and he was flipping this cold baby over, hitting a stainless steel desk. And if I hear anything like that sound in my life today, I mean, if it's at a restaurant or anything, that image of that baby is front and center in my mind. And that's not getting shot at. You know, my life wasn't in jeopardy. So I think my goal, at least, or I think the association's goal, is not to create some windfall for officers that are experiencing this either. We just want to treat them. As the sheriff pointed out, we don't have the same autonomy that he has as a constitutional officer. I have to work through a city. We have to work through cities. Now, if I go and try to do exactly what he did, my workman's comp, who works for the finance department, is going to say, you're exposing us to workman's comp exposure. I don't like that answer. And that's what I'm trying to, you know, move forward. I thank you for asking the question.
Go ahead.
All right. I mean, I could talk to you guys forever. And thank you, Mr. Chair. So, last question. You know, I'm from deep south Miami-Dade, right? So I have Miami-Dade issues. And I know for a fact that none of us want to see the shootings that happen in the communities. None of us want to see it continue. None of us want to watch the news and hear about a birthday party getting shot up, right? My question is, from a legislative standpoint, is there anything that we can do to help you get the shooters off the street? I know it's a big question.
That's so easy. I'm going to let Chief Slaughter handle that first.
You know, I guess the basic question of criminology all the time is, who do you put in jail or prison? And if there is one violation, that, you know, people involved in criminal activity with guns, I think if they put them with efficiency in the prison, I know it's going to be contrary to wanting. I don't want $5 billion either. But I want to spend $4 billion, but I want the right guy in there. And the guys that are running around doing crime with guns really need to be in there. And I think the less flexible and the more certain, swift, and severe we are with that approach, I think we are going to do much better. I don't think you'll find too many police officers, when an incident like that happens, that they don't already have a pretty good I know that person. The community knows that person. You probably know some of those people. And if we identify the people that are, you know, committed to doing a criminal activity with guns and put them in jail or prison and protect society from them, I think we've come a long way. I think we struggle with it.
I think pragmatically, most of these folks that are dealing with these crimes of violence, right, you typically don't start with shooting 4 and 5. There have been precursors, right? There have been opportunities to be for an intervention. And going back to the point about juveniles, really, discipline, fair, consistent, and swift. You know, discipline delayed has ramifications. And so when you take someone who has a propensity for violence, and those indicators, violence against children, violence against their significant others, these types of things that you've seen before, and a propensity to use or engage in the use of firearms, we cannot be shocked and amazed when these things continue, right? But if they go to probation and they can't do probation and they don't do community control and all that's need to be dealt with, Mike Atkinson, dealt with swiftly and appropriately, and sentences. I actually, as much as I love picking on judges, I actually believe in giving a little more discretion to a judge in that regard, so that they have some opportunities to take the totality of a pre-sentence investigation and say,
this person has a propensity for violence. I demonstrated. We're not asking to be arbitrary and capricious. We're saying simply, you've done this thing. You know, you saw the Brevard County shooting, I'm sure, involving the deputy sheriff. You heard the number of felonies and out on bond for a crime of violence. We have to be pragmatic that there are people who are deserving of probation and second chance community control. But quite frankly, there are people that need to be in prison to protect the rest of us. And that is the reality. They cannot conform to the rules of society. I'm not saying how they got that way. I'm not saying there aren't mitigating factors. All that is absolutely true. But it's not relevant to the fact as to whether or not they pose a risk.
Thank you. I don't have any other member questions, and I don't have any speaker cards. If we have no public testimony, and I don't see any, I want to thank you both. Thank you, members, for the back and forth, and I think it's been very enlightening. You truly have been a dynamic duo today, and I'm proud to know that you're going back to your agencies, and those agencies are in good hands. And thank you for bringing the staff. I appreciate. I see Cookie and Matt out there for coming from the Sheriff's Association and the Police Chiefs Association. Thank you for being here today, discussing very important issues. I hope it was enlightening. You gave us the lay of the land and kind of told us what it's like on the streets out there. And sometimes it's the mean streets. You see people in their worst element, but you also see them in their best. And the one thing about your job, it's different every day. It's never boring. I mean, one moment you're at grandma's house because the neighbor's cow's eating the flowers in her garden. The next minute you're consoling a parent who's maybe lost their child in an automobile accident. So it is a very tough job. And I think you've opened our eyes to a lot of things. So thank you for discussing a lot of important issues and answering our questions. We want to work together to make sure Florida and Florida's law enforcement community as a whole has the tools it needs to effectively do your jobs and keep us all safe in Florida, because that's our number one job, is keeping us safe. So thank you for being here. And members, if you have no other business that maybe should be properly transacted today, Representative Snyder, you'll move that we will rise. See an objection. We are adjourned. Thank you all.